Chapter 10. Vijayanagara, 1336 to 1646. Today, the lands of India are united in a single modern nation, but it is perhaps one of the most diverse nation-states on earth, and certainly the largest with so many different cultures within its borders. The citizens of Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, Maharashtra, and all the 28 states of modern India are as different from one another as those of France, Germany, and Italy. They vary in their traditional dress, diet, ritual observances, and in the 22 major languages spoken across the subcontinent. But perhaps the most marked differences from region to region are in the realm of religion. Today, the word Hinduism is applied clumsily to the great variety of religious traditions that originate in India, and take as their starting point the ancient Sanskrit texts of the Vedas, first recorded in writing around 3,500 years ago. Many Hindus refer to their religion as Sanatana Dharma, the eternal way or the eternal duty. But Indian religion was never united or systematized under a central authority. Though many people now consider these diverse traditions, sects, and orders to be a single religion, in the past they were seen as significantly different, and hostility has often existed between them. In very simple terms, Hindus believe in one god named Brahman, who is refracted into many different aspects. The way a beam of white light refracted through a prism can be shown to contain many colors. The ancient text, the Maitri Upanishad, explains this concept, in which each living being also contains a spark of this original God. Verily, that one became threefold, eightfold, elevenfold, twelvefold, into an infinite number of parts. He has entered into and moves among created beings. He became the overlord of created beings. That is the soul within and without, yea, within and without. Although Brahman can manifest in many ways, most Hindus predominantly worship one of two manifestations of this supreme power, Shiva and Vishnu. In Hinduism, Shiva is both the creator and the destroyer, a beautiful and fearsome god who represents the primal energy of the universe. He is often depicted as a dancer, pirouetting the universe from creation to destruction and back, and on into eternity. Shiva embodies the idea that life and death are part of the same process. A beautiful mushroom might spring out of the decay of a fallen oak. The flesh of a gazelle gives life to the lion. The fall of one civilization gives rise to another. Vishnu, on the other hand, is the preserver, the one who holds things together, if only for a time. Whenever the need arises, he appears on earth in human form, embodied as great mythical heroes like Rama and Krishna, and ensures that the world retains its balance. The tales of these heroes are told in a vast collection of texts, and the greatest of these is known today as the Mahabharata, or Epic of India. The Mahabharata has similarities in theme and scope with Homer's epics, and with ancient compendiums of history and myth, such as the Bible. It tells the story of how the lands of North India were divided in two by a war between two great powers, and ends in a great world-ending battle, after which the age of heroes and giants comes to a close, and our age, the final age of man, begins. At around 1.8 million words, the Mahabharata is perhaps the longest piece of literature ever written, roughly 10 times the length of the Iliad and Odyssey combined, and it forms a chaotic and magnificent tapestry of myth and legend that has few equals. In the past, India has often been depicted by historians as a kind of geographical fortress, sealed off on every side by the mountains and sea. But in fact, this is far from the case. The seas that might appear to hem it in were actually busy highways, with constant trade and traffic connecting India to the Persian Gulf and Red Sea on one side, and Cambodia, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, and China on the other. Indian pepper and cinnamon flavored the meals eaten by faraway Roman senators, and an Indian bronze Buddha figurine has even been found in a 9th century Viking grave on the small Swedish island of Helgo. In the northwest, the mountains of Pakistan and Afghanistan were a formidable boundary, but a number of routes like the Khyber and Bolan passes cut through their rugged cliffs and allowed Alexander the Great to march his large army into the Punjab in the 4th century BCE. He would be followed by many other would-be conquerors down the ages. And while the Himalayas were the most impenetrable boundary of all, that didn't stop Indian Buddhism from spreading across them into Tibet and onwards, reaching as far north as Japan. However, as the world entered the second half of the first millennium, India's contact with the outside led to a new religion entering the diverse mix of Indian belief. The younger faith of Islam would bring both conquest and culture. It would create a rift that split the subcontinent in two, but would also connect it to the capital cities of the wider world and bring a new age of prosperity and advancement. The arrival of Islam to India heralded a time of paradoxes, contrasts, and ironies. And chief among these was that it spurred the rise of one of the greatest Hindu empires on the Indian peninsula, the Empire of Vijayanagara. The history of Islam in India is long and complex. According to traditional claims, it arrived on the shores of the subcontinent during the life of the Prophet Muhammad, brought by traders who arrived by sea from the Persian Gulf. But while in the south, Islam arrived along these trade routes, the arrival of Islam in the north was a much less peaceful affair. As we have seen, the Muslim Empire emerged swiftly, recreating the conquests of Alexander and rising to become a major power within 20 years of the Prophet Muhammad's death, clear proof for its devotees of the divine nature of Islam's revelations. But like Alexander's empire after his death, its territory soon broke apart into separate kingdoms. Each of these was ruled over by sultans, a word derived from the Arabic sultan, power or authority, and now stretched across the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia. For a few centuries, the sultanates did not progress beyond the boundary of the Indus River in the north. But in the early 1190s, a warlord called Muhammad Ghuri invaded from the Khor region of Afghanistan and captured the regional capital of Delhi, establishing his own Muslim kingdom there. By the year 1300, the Delhi Sultanate had established a lasting power that stretched from the Indus Valley to the Bay of Bengal, from the foothills of the Himalayas to the arid plateau of the Deccan in central India. This power was Sunni Islamic, culturally a blend of Turkic and Persian traditions, and in its more stable moments, its rulers dreamed of expanding ever further into the south and eventually raising their banner over the entire subcontinent. These dreams would finally be realized by perhaps the most complex and controversial figure to ever rule India, a man named Muhammad bin Tughluq. Muhammad bin Tughluq was a mercurial ruler. On one hand, he was an intellectual, a lover of poetry, an expert in the Quran and Islamic law, who could speak Persian, Arabic, Turkish, and Sanskrit. Like all the sultans of Delhi, he was Muslim, but was mostly tolerant of other religions. and was the only sultan recorded to take part in his people's Hindu festivals. On the other hand, all that erudition could not disguise his darker side. His court scholars record that he came to the throne after the death of his father and his brother, the crown prince, in a freak accident, when a pavilion they were sitting under collapsed. "A thunderbolt from the sky descended upon the earth," writes one scholar named Bharani, "and the roof under which the sultan was seated fell down, crushing him and five or six other persons so that they died." However, the traveller Ibn Battuta was visiting Delhi at the time and records quite a different version of events, that in fact the pavilion had been rigged to collapse. The scheme was that whenever the elephants would tread on one side of it, the whole building would fall in ruins, and the elephants were led up from one direction as was planned. And when they walked on that side, the pavilion fell in on the sultan and his son Mahmud. Muhammad bin Tughluq gave orders to fetch axes and mattocks in order to dig for them, but he made a sign to delay, and in consequence they were not brought out until after sunset. They cleared away the ruins and found the sultan dead, with his back bent over his son to protect him. As with many rulers who came to power through treachery, Muhammad bin Tughluq spent his reign in a state of deep paranoia. He doled out extremely harsh punishments, often executing those who displeased him, and this cruel streak earned him the epithet Muhammad Kuni, or Muhammad the Bloody. One chronicler, the Persian scholar Firishtar, who settled in India in the 16th century, wondered at how, "so little did he hesitate to spill the blood of God's creatures, that one might have supposed his object was to exterminate the human species altogether." Another report by the Portuguese writer and traveller Fernão Nunes even recounts a popular story about how he once declared war on the sun after it had the temerity to shine into his eye. Despite this arbitrary ruler, by this time the power of the Delhi Sultanate was seemingly unstoppable. It continued to grow, swallowing up a South Indian people known as the Kakatiyas and other surrounding Hindu kingdoms. By the 1350s, the Sultanate stretched for thousands of kilometers, forming a belt across India from sea to sea, nearly encompassing the entire peninsula. The threat must have put all the Hindu rulers of South India on high alert. But the mad Sultan Muhammad bin Tughluq died in 1351, and after his death, the Sultanate of Delhi began to disintegrate. Many of its newly conquered lands rose up in rebellion. Opportunist enemies to the north soon got word of the anarchy, and in 1398, the Turco-Mongolian warlord Timur descended on Delhi and put it to the sword. Timur had no intention of staying in India. He simply gathered up loot, women, and slaves as he passed through and returned to his capital of Samarkand in modern Uzbekistan. But like the sacking of Rome, his destruction of Delhi tore the heart out of an already struggling empire. Into this terrain of blood and fire, two brothers would rise from obscure beginnings and transform this region. They would move the center of Indian power from the Muslim north to the Hindu south and build a city that would stand among the greatest in the medieval world. They were known as the Sangama brothers, and their names were Booker and Harihara. The exact origins of the Sangama brothers are wreathed in mystery. Many historians believe it's likely that Harihara and Booker were commanders of the southern Hoysala Empire, stationed on the Tungabhadra River in what is now the state of Karnataka, with orders to repel any Muslim incursions from the north. Other myths recount how they were captured and held as prisoners of war by the Delhi Sultanate. Whatever the case, it's clear that as the Delhi Sultanate collapsed, Harihara and Bukka raised a considerable army, which included large cohorts of Muslim mercenaries, possibly former Sultanate soldiers who were no longer getting paid, and fought to establish an independent Hindu state in South India. The historian Robert Sewell recounts one legend about Harihara. During his reign, this chief was one day hunting amongst the mountains south of the river when a hare, instead of fleeing from his dogs, flew at them and bit them. The king, astonished at this marvel, was returning homewards lost in meditation when he met on the riverbank the sage named Vidyaranya, or Forest of Learning, who advised the chief to found a city on that spot. This fable offers an illuminating image of how the young power of Vijayanagara would come to see itself, as the hunted rabbit who turned round and learned how to bite. With this force, the brothers set out to capture the areas that the disintegrating Delhi Sultanate had left unguarded. Within a few decades, they would absorb a large and wealthy portion of South India. At their former post, an unassuming village on the rocky banks of the Tungabhadra River, they laid the foundations of a city that would announce the arrival of this new and confident power. They named it Vijayanagara, from the Sanskrit Vijaya, meaning victory, and Nagara, meaning city, the city of victory. Vijayanagara was a city of soaring temples and wide avenues, with sophisticated urban planning, and it was also a formidable fortress. The surrounding landscape is dominated by huge granite boulders, heaped up into impassable hills that provide excellent natural defenses, while the torrential Tungabhadra River protected it on the north side, almost impossible for an army to ford. The brothers enhanced these natural defenses by fortifying the passes between the hills with strong gates and towers. These massive walls, which can still be traced in the landscape, enclosed an area of more than 650 square kilometers. An ambassador for the Timurid ruler of Persia, a man named Abd al-Razik Samarkandi, visited in the early 1440s. It is built in such a manner that seven citadels and the same number of walls enclose each other, he wrote. The seventh fortress, which is placed in the center of the other, occupies an area 10 times larger than the marketplace of the city of Herat. These ramparts were manned by soldiers who surveyed the broad roads that ran in and out of the city. Between the concentric rings of walls were areas filled with obstructive boulders known as horse stones, designed to guarantee that any attacking army would have a difficult time advancing, while the soldiers of Vijayanagara rained arrows down on their heads. Looking at the wider region around Vijayanagara, it's not hard to see why they considered these defenses essential. Across the region, a number of Muslim kingdoms had emerged from the fragments of the Delhi Sultanate, and of these, the most powerful was the Bahmani Sultanate. According to tradition, the Bahmani Sultanate was founded by an army commander named Zafar Khan, who had served under the erratic Sultan, Muhammad bin Tughluq, before declaring independence in 1347. It quickly grew into an impressive dominion in the heart of South India that would last for the next 170 years. And for the people of Vijayanagara, it represented a constant looming threat on their border. Nationalist historians in India and in the West have often framed the conflict between these two medieval kingdoms in cultural terms, imagining the kingdom of Vijayanagara as a bastion, defending Hindu culture against Islamic invaders. But there's little evidence that the rulers or citizens of Vijayanagara thought this way. One inscription from the time of the Sangama brothers depicts the Bahmani sultans as just one of their enemies, with the others being rival Hindu kingdoms. When his sword began to dance on the battlefield, the faces of the Turushkas Turks, shriveled up. Konkana Sankaparya was filled with fear. The Andras ran into caves. The Gurjaras lost the use of their limbs on every road. The Kambojas' courage was broken. The Kalingas suffered defeat. Here there is no hint that the Bahmanis were any more despicable to the kings of Vijayanagara than the many Hindu kingdoms, with whom they fought equally long and bitter wars. Indeed, the idea of a unified Hindu identity simply didn't exist in the 14th century. In fact, conflict between the Bahmani sultans and Vijayanagara most often arose over practical and economic matters, like access to resources, supply lines, and trade routes. One bitter issue of contention was a fertile tract of land between them, rich in iron, gold, and diamonds, known as the Raichur Doab. Other conflicts would break out over wealthy port towns on the east and west coasts, which controlled trade with the Muslim world, and were a crucial conduit for the most important military resource of the time, war horses imported from Arabia, Persia, and Central Asia. Thanks to their close trade and cultural links to the rest of the Muslim world, the Bahmanis were always better supplied with horses, and so their sultan would become known as Ashvapati, the Lord of Horses, while the kings of Vijayanagara were known by the title Narapati, the Lord of Men, alluding to their armies of massed infantry. The kings of the Gajapatis in the east, with their vast stables of elephants, became known as the Lord of Elephants, completing the triangle. In the early days, Vijayanagara's infantry force was no match for the horsepower of the Bahmani sultans, and the tradition of learning across the Muslim world also gave the Bahmanis a technological advantage. One of the first sultans, Muhammad Shah Bahmani, was an early adopter of the new technology of gunpowder weaponry, which had reached India from China via the Mongols. At this time, it was used mostly to create exploding projectiles to be fired from catapults, and occasionally crude rockets. But soon, the sound of cannon fire would ring out over the battlefields of medieval India, and the Bahmani sultans' head start with this technology would put them in a strong position in the coming centuries. For these reasons, although it was the larger and often wealthier kingdom, Vijayanagara frequently found itself on the losing side of wars with its Muslim neighbor. These were not, however, wars of conquest. The two kingdoms would fight over a seaport, a strip of land, or a certain fort, but when the result became clear, the loser would sue for peace, pay an enormous sum of money to the victor, often hand over a daughter in marriage, and return home. There was never any suggestion that one side would conquer and consume the other. Still, the Bahmanis were of growing concern to the kings of Vijayanagara. Despite the danger of its northern rival, from the mid-14th century, the city of Vijayanagara grew steadily, from the center of a wealthy kingdom into a great world capital. It would soon house as many as 300,000 people, at a time when Paris, the largest city in Europe, had little more than 200,000 inhabitants. By 1500, with the Cambodian city of Angkor now depopulated, Vijayanagara was probably the world's second largest city after Beijing, and it was probably India's richest. Vijayanagara was truly a city of stone. All its palaces and temples, its towers and walls, even the ordinary houses, were carved out of solid blocks of granite cut from the surrounding terrain. "The city of Bijnagar simply has no equal in the world," wrote Abd al-Razak. "It is such that the pupil of the eye has never seen a place like it, and the ear of intelligence has never been informed that there existed anything to equal it in the entire world." In the early 16th century, the Portuguese traveller Domingo Paes also visited. The size of the city cannot all be seen from any one spot, but I climbed a hill whence I could see a great part of it. I could not see it all because it lies between several ranges of hills. What I saw from thence seemed to me as large as Rome, and very beautiful to the sight. Vijayanagara was divided into several districts, each with a unique character. In an area known today as the sacred center, the Virupaksha temple still soars out of the ruins of the city. The streets here would have been full of the sounds of chanted hymns and clanging temple bells, incense smoke, and the pleas of the faithful as they came to pray, to be healed, to be closer to the gods. Further south lay what's been termed the urban core, a large walled area that contained both houses and markets, as well as workshops, rest houses, and other places of business. There were temples for Jains here, as well as Hindu followers of Vishnu and Shiva, and one area with a mosque. The Portuguese traveller Duarte Barbosa, arriving in Vijayanagara around 1501, gave the following description of this district. The folk here are ever in such numbers that the streets and places cannot contain them. There is a great traffic and an endless number of merchants and wealthy men. The king allows such freedom that every man may come and go and love according to his creed, without suffering any annoyance, and without inquiry whether he is Christian, Jew, Moor, or heathen. Barbosa pays particular attention to the smells that wafted from the spice markets. Here also is used vermilion, saffron, rosewater, great store of opium, sandal's wood, aloes wood, camphor musk, and scented materials. Likewise, much pepper is used here and everywhere throughout the kingdom, which they bring hither from Malabar. We can imagine scenes of family life, children running in the streets, wood smoke billowing overhead, men gathered to play games of chance and strategy on street corners, while chewing betel nuts and leaves, which are still chewed across India for their mild, stimulant effect. The day of an average citizen of Vijayanagara would have started with a visit to a local bathhouse. Men and women had separate bathing places, which were available at different times of the day. After bathing, families would go to their local temple to give offerings and receive blessings for the day ahead. Shopkeepers in this part of the city and everywhere else would have needed to be constantly alert to the mischief of the monkeys, the red-faced rhesus macaques, and the silvery Hanuman langurs, huge troops of which still live in the region. Now, as then, these animals love nothing better than to drop down from shop awnings and steal food from anyone who has let down their guard. From outside the city walls, lines of bullock carts laden with local produce like rice, millet, squashes, and other vegetables would have snaked through the lacework of surrounding towns, roads, and fields, heading for market. Towering over it all was the royal center, an area of monumental palaces and mansions that were home to the wealthy elite. While they were Hindu, it's clear these elites had great admiration for their Muslim rivals to the north. The architecture of their homes clearly displays a blend of South Indian and Islamic styles. Some wall paintings in Vijayanagara even depict the court wearing Muslim fashions for formal events, tall caps and flowing gowns. On one hand, the rulers of Vijayanagara clearly modeled themselves on the South Indian empires of the past, like the Chalukyas, the Pandyas, and the Cholas. But they also evinced a radical and forward-looking desire for new influences from the Muslim world and beyond. After all, in the fast-moving world of medieval India, kingdoms that fell behind didn't last long. Soon, one king in particular would come to power who was determined to modernize and hybridize Vijayanagara and end the days of paying tribute to the powerful Muslim kingdoms to the north. His name was Devaraya II. Devaraya II was a boy when he came to the throne as the Raya or ruler of Vijayanagara in 1432. Abdul Razak, who visited some 10 years later, describes the young king. The king was dressed in a robe of green satin. Around his neck, he wore a collar composed of pearls. He was of an olive color, of a spare body and rather tall. He was exceedingly young, for there was only some slight down upon his cheeks and none upon his chin. His whole appearance was very prepossessing. Aspiring to turn his empire from a defensive, inward-looking kingdom into a modern state, Devaraya sent out word to the Muslim world that Vijayanagara's doors were open. He welcomed talented Muslims into his court and enlisted as many as 200 Muslim officers into his army, giving them homes and even building a mosque in Vijayanagara. He also commanded that no one should molest them in exercise of their religion, writes Firishtar. And moreover, he ordered a Quran to be placed before his throne on a rich desk, so that the faithful might perform the ceremony of obeisance in his presence without sinning against their laws. Vijayanagara would soon have a thriving Muslim quarter. Some carvings on the great temples show Muslims taking part in the daily life of the city, Arab horse handlers taking care of their steeds, and beturbaned Muslim riders rearing up on those imported horses. To these Muslim mercenaries would soon be added units of Muslim gunners trained in the use of muskets. Devaraya II also engaged in large infrastructure projects, digging vast networks of irrigation canals that expanded the agricultural potential of the land around the city, allowing the metropolis to boom to even greater size. In 1443, Abdul Razak, despite having arrived from the wealthy Silk Road city of Samarkand, was struck by the resplendence of the citizens of Vijayanagara. All the inhabitants of the country, whether high or low, even down to the artificers of the bazaar, wear jewels and gilt ornaments in their ears and around their necks, arms, wrists, and fingers. The king has many elephants in the country, but the large ones are specially reserved for the palace. The king has a white elephant, exceedingly large, with here and there as many as 30 spots of colour. Every morning this animal is brought into the presence of the monarch, for to cast eye upon him is thought a favourable omen. He even gives a bashful account of the city's apparently thriving red light district, reporting that the splendour of those houses, the beauty of the heart ravishers, their blandishments and ogles are beyond all description. It is best to be brief on the matter. When Al-Razak was brought in to meet the 19-year-old king, Devaraya bombarded his visitor with questions about the Muslim powers of the world, how many horsemen the king of Persia had under his command, what his great nobles were like and how they behaved, what the great cities of Herat and Shiraz were like, and so on, clearly showing his curiosity and admiration for the Muslim world. But things at court were not always plain sailing, and the king sat at the top of a fragile hierarchy packed with jealous rivals. While Abdul Razak was staying in the city, Devaraya II was the target of one particularly dramatic assassination attempt by one of his brothers, which shows how dangerous ruling Vijayanagara could be. This unnatural brother drew forth the poignard and wounded him several times severely, so that the monarch fell down behind the throne. And the perfidious wretch, believing that he was dead, left one of his myrmidons behind to cut off the king's head. He himself rushed out to the portico of the palace and exclaimed, "I have killed the king, his brothers, the nobles, the ministers, and the other chiefs, and I am now your king." But he had not counted on Devaraya's resilience. As the soldier approached to decapitate him, the king fought back in dramatic fashion. But when the bravo advanced to fulfill his murderous orders, the king, seizing the seat behind which he had fallen, dealt with it such a blow upon the breast of the villain that he felled him to the ground and ran out of the chamber by the way of the female apartments, while his brother, seated at the head of the tribunal of justice, was inviting the people to recognize him as their sovereign, the king himself came forward and exclaimed, "Behold, I am alive and safe. Seize the assassin." The multitude immediately bore him down and slew him. Devariah II did eventually die in 1446. He had left his kingdom a larger, wealthier, and more outward-looking place than he had found it. But the period that followed was one of chaos and dissolution. Devariah's son is said mysteriously to have died of a broken heart, perhaps a euphemism for poison, while his grandson, who next took the throne, was murdered by his own son, who would go on to be killed by his own younger brother. Observing the chaos among the royal family, soon the commanders of the military hungered for power themselves. One of these, a general named Saluva Narasimha, seized the throne in a military coup in 1485 and ended the Sangama dynasty that had ruled since the founding of Vijayanagara 150 years earlier. Saluva Narasimha was a poet and self-styled expert in lovemaking, but he didn't seem to care much for the boring business of ruling the kingdom. He spent much of his reign writing a long book of detailed erotic instruction and died only a few years after taking the throne. During the reigns of the hapless kings that followed, in 1498, a small fleet of four Portuguese ships, captained by the explorer Vasco da Gama, arrived in South India. The first European to ever successfully complete this journey by sea, and he returned with cinnamon and pepper, silk and jewels. For the first time, Europeans had circumvented the Silk Road, and a new system of global trade would supercharge their economies in the centuries to come. The Portuguese would soon set up a trading post at Goa on India's west coast, and for centuries to come, Europeans would continually increase their presence and influence in India. The king of Vijayanagara at the time offered one of his daughters in marriage to King Manuel of Portugal in exchange for sending a Portuguese princess to marry him, so that two kings would be allied for the purpose of joint actions on land and sea, that the blood of the two royal houses would mingle. The Portuguese declined the offer. But other than this, the appearance of these foreigners excited little attention in the court of Vijayanagara. The time of upheaval was put to an end with the reign of the most famous of the emperors of South India. He was a ruler named Krishnadeva Raya, the last great king of Vijayanagara. Krishnadeva was never meant to be king. He was the son of a lower-ranking queen than his two brothers, and so they both got a shot at ruling before he did. But they catastrophically mismanaged the kingdom and faced constant rebellions and uprisings. When Krishnadeva's brother lay on his deathbed, he was determined that his own infant grandson should take the throne. He ordered that his brother should be blinded, which under Indian law would disqualify him from ruling. According to legend, the king's manservants brought him the eyes of a recently slaughtered goat and told him that his wishes had been carried out. The king died satisfied that his line was secure, and Krishnadeva took the throne as Krishnadeva Raya. Domingo Paez described the new king as of medium height and of fair complexion and good figure, rather fat than thin. He has on his face signs of smallpox, and praised him as a great ruler and a man of much justice, but subject to sudden fits of rage. Paez also records that the king was what we might think of as a fitness fanatic. This king is accustomed every day to drink a quartillo of oil of sesame before daylight, and anoints himself all over with the said oil. He covers his loins with a small cloth and takes in his arms great weights made of earthenware, and then, taking a sword, he exercises himself with it till he has sweated out all the oil, and then he wrestles with one of his wrestlers. After this labor, he mounts a horse and gallops about the plain in one direction and another till dawn, for he does all this before daybreak. Krishna Devaraya showed a similar energetic attitude to his rule. One of his first acts was to bring the troublesome elephant lords of the nearby Gajapati kingdom back under his control, seizing important forts along the way. This victory must have boosted his reputation at home and fed what was apparently an enormous ego. "Overcome by his glory," gushes one royal inscription. "The sun sinks into the western ocean as if quite unable to endure the distress of mind." But Krishnadeva was also an eminently practical man. He published a series of political maxims in his work Amuktamalyada that contained advice for how a kingdom should be ruled. "A king should improve the harbors of his country and so encourage its commerce. Make the merchants of distant foreign countries who import elephants and good horses attached to yourself by providing them with daily audience, presents, and allowing decent profits. Then those articles will never go to your enemies." Under Krishnadeva, the Vijayanagara Empire nearly doubled in size. To mark his accession, in 1510 he ordered the construction of a grand gateway tower, known as a gopura, to adorn the temple to the god Virupaksha. This remarkable structure was built on mathematical principles, using a fractal design in which individual elements of the tower resemble the whole. This gives the tower a mesmerizing shape and represents the infinite repetition of universes that lies at the heart of Hindu cosmology. This was a true golden age in South India, a time of peace, stability, and prosperity, but it was not to last. In little more than 50 years, this vast city would be destroyed, emptied of its population and left to crumble into the earth. And this dramatic downfall began with what at the time must have felt like a brilliant victory, the collapse of their long-standing rival, the Bahmani Sultanate. Like Vijayanagara, the Bahmani Sultanate had for decades been enthusiastically importing people from across the Muslim world, soldiers, architects, artists, holy men, and scholars. They had helped to transform it into a world center of culture and innovation. But this policy also had its costs. The Indian Bahmanis felt increasingly resentful of the newcomers, mostly Persian-speaking Iranians, who they referred to as the Westerners. Towards the end of the 15th century, this anger turned mutinous. When the enraged ruler of the city of Ahmednagar rebelled in 1490, the other regions soon followed. By 1518, 9 years into Krishnadevaraya's reign, the Bahmani Sultanate had fractured into 5 individual kingdoms, all fighting among themselves. The power of the Bahmani sultans had evaporated in a matter of years, and Vijayanagara was now all but unchallenged in the south of India. For Krishnadevaraya, now in his late 40s and nearly a decade into his reign, this chaos presented an obvious opportunity. That rich triangle of land known as the Raichur Doab, with its fertile farmland and mineral wealth, was now in the hands of Ismail Adil Shah, the Sultan of Bijapur. In 1520, Krishnadevaraya marched an army of 100,000 soldiers across the Tungabhadra River and laid siege to the fort of Raichur. This conquest would not be as easy as Krishnadeva hoped. The kings of Vijayanagara had not taken advantage of the developing technology of the cannon as their Bahmani rivals had, and they also lacked effective siege equipment. The Hindus resorted to old-fashioned tactics, hacking away at the fort walls with pickaxes and hammers. The defenders, meanwhile, well stocked with cannons, rained fire and death down from the walls. It seemed like the siege would last forever, until Krishnadeva got word that the Sultan of Bijapur himself was marching an army towards him, equipped with nearly 1,000 of the latest powerful cannons imported from Persia. Perhaps feeling a tremble of apprehension, Krishnadeva lifted the siege and went out to meet the Sultan in battle. When the two armies met, the Sultan ordered his cannoneers to fire all their guns at once in a devastating volley. His hope was that the psychological impact of the massive bombardment would break the will of the Vijayanagara soldiers, and he was right. 1,000 cannonballs tore through the Vijayanagara ranks, forcing them to retreat. It looked like all was lost for Vijayanagara. But, as the Portuguese witness Fernão Nunes recalls, Krishnadevaraya refused to admit defeat. He rallied his generals and elite cavalry around him and gave them a stunning and quite ruthless order. "Who ranges himself with me?" he cried. Then he took a ring from his finger and gave it to one of his pages so that he might show it to his queens in token of his death. Then he mounted a horse and moved forward with all his remaining divisions, commanding to slay without mercy every man of those who had fled. Krishnadeva and his generals managed to make them turn and run in the opposite direction, towards the Bahmani forces. The pure crushing weight of these bodies, backed by as many as 27,000 horses, turned the tide back on the Muslim soldiers. The Sultan's cannons, having all fired at once, had to reload all at the same time, and they were unable to summon another volley before they were overrun. Krishnadeva's forces drove them into the Krishna River, where a massacre began. The rabbit had once again turned and bitten its pursuer. Krishnadevaraya now besieged the fort of Raichur, with the support of a company of Portuguese mercenaries who had brought with them the latest arquebuses. This type of long-barreled gun achieved an astonishing degree of accuracy for early firearms, so much so that one of these Portuguese snipers was apparently able to kill the fort's commander when he raised his head above the rampart, with either a very skillful or a very lucky shot. The captain of the city, seeing the dismay that had spread amongst his people, began to turn them back with encouraging words, and he, wishing to see for himself where the Portuguese were, reached over with his body in front of one of the embrasures and was killed with a musket shot that struck him in the middle of the forehead. Raichur Fort surrendered soon after. These rich contested lands now belonged to Vijayanagara. But Krishnadevaraya's victory caused a ripple of concern among the kingdoms of the region, especially those that had once been part of the Bahmani Sultanate. A number of diplomats were dispatched from neighboring kingdoms to urge the king not to try to expand his empire any further. If he ignored their warnings, they said, the kingdoms would be forced to unite against him. With our gift of hindsight, we know that Krishnadeva should have taken this threat very seriously, but instead he sent each of them the same reply. "I pray you, do not take the trouble to come hither, for I will myself go to seek ye if ye dare to await me in your lands, and this I send you for answer." In fact, Krishnadeva was so emboldened that he decided to do what no king of Vijayanagara had dreamed of before. That was to march north and seize the Sultan's capital city of Bijapur itself. Bijapur was one of the largest and wealthiest cities in the lands that had once been part of the Bahmani Sultanate. It was a centre of culture, trade and commerce, as well as of learning and scholarship, and contained a number of lavish gardens and water pavilions. Farnaw Nunez travelled with Krishnadevaraya as he embarked on this campaign far into enemy territory, and recalls catching sight of Bijapur as Krishnadeva's armies approached. "It has numbers of beautiful houses built according to our own fashion, with many bowers and gardens made of grapevines, and pomegranates and oranges and lemons, and all other kinds of garden produce." Meanwhile, seeing Krishnadeva's army on the horizon, the Sultan of Bijapur did the only thing he could. He fled the city and went into hiding. Krishnadeva entered the city with little resistance and decided to stay there until the Sultan handed himself over and consented to kiss the foot of Krishnadevaraya. As it turned out, this was a long time. During their stay in the city, to keep themselves warm and fed, Krishnadevaraya's soldiers demolished its beautiful buildings for firewood, and they drank its reservoirs dry. The city was left almost in ruins, not that the king had commanded it to be destroyed, but that his troops, in order to make fires for cooking, had torn down so many houses that it was a great grief to see. The Sultan Adil Shah sent to ask the king what wrong the houses had done that he commanded to destroy them, for there remained no other houses standing save only the palaces where the king Krishnadeva was staying. The king sent answer that it was not he who had done it, but that he could not control his people. Eventually, the drinking water supply exhausted, Krishnadeva was forced to leave. He had not captured the Sultan of Bijapur, but he had certainly made his point. Vijayanagara was without doubt the strongest power in South India. The destruction of Bijapur was a stinging reminder to the sultans in the region that if they continued fighting among themselves, a greater enemy to the south would swallow them up one by one. Krishnadevaraya died on the 17th of October, 1529. His eldest son had been poisoned as a child, a victim of palace intrigue, and his next son was too young to be considered. So on the king's death, the crown passed to his feckless younger brother, Achyuta. Nunez remembers him as a man of very little honesty, who gave himself over to vice and tyranny. With the credibility of the crown so compromised, a number of opportunists fancied their chances at seizing the throne. Chief among these was a divisive and ruthless social climber named Rama Raya. Rama Raya began his career as a courtier in the kingdom of Golconda, to the north of Vijayanagara. But he had a keen nose for opportunity, and during the reign of Krishnadeva, he made his way south to the Hindu court to serve him. Rama Raya's mother was the daughter of a chieftain in the east, affording him enough social standing to marry one of the king's daughters. And as the now son-in-law to Krishnadevaraya, the ambitious Rama Raya worked to increase his power and influence in the court. When the feckless Achyuta died after ruling for 13 years, Rama Raya raised a successful rebellion and placed a young boy, a distant nephew of Krishnadeva, on the throne. As the boy's regent, Rama Raya, then aged around 57, became the true power behind the throne. When this young king reached adulthood and suggested that he might now be old enough to take over the reins of the state, Rama Raya had him imprisoned. The boy king would now appear only once a year to the crowds, while Rama Raya acted as emperor. By 1562, even these annual appearances were stopped, and Rama Raya was the unchallenged head of state. One of the great composers of this time was a man named Kanakadasa, who lived through this period. One of his famous songs describes how many of the citizens of Vijayanagara must have felt as the kingdom descended into corruption over the 23 years of Rama Raya's regime? Where did truth and duty go? The noble can't survive anymore. Thieves and habitual adulterers strike it rich. The rest are poor. No one pays the soldiers. No helping rains shower the earth. Those with food and clothes are corrupted by bribery. Worshippers of Shiva are clashing with the Vishnu devotees. Great offerings are made to the most horrific, violent gods. Who could list all the wrongs of the time? Rama Raya's devious plotting was not restricted to matters in his own court. The sultans of the Deccan often asked for Vijayanagara's help in their wars against one another, and Rama Raya happily allied himself first with one, then another, with the hope of thereby weakening them all. And often breaking his promises not to destroy mosques or unnecessarily hurt Muslim civilians. One of these sultans, Hussein Nazim Shah of the Sultanate of Ahmadnagar, grew to particularly hate Rama Raya. Farishtar recalls one meeting between them, when the king of Vijayanagara openly insulted his guest. At the time of the meeting, Ramraj, Rama Raya, showed great vanity and loftiness, and remained seated, and had Hussein Nizam Shah kiss his hand in this manner. Hussein Nizam Shah was furious at the improper behavior of Ramraj, and in order to reproach the Raja, he at once, in that very company, called for water and washed his hands. On seeing this, Ramraj was enraged and said in the Kannadi language, "If this man were not my guest, I would instantly cut him to bits with my sword." The final straw apparently came when Rama Raya sent Hussein a long and insulting list of demands for tribute. According to the Muslim poet named Hasan Shawki, this included camels from Kabul, ambergris, aloes, musk, a large silver bell, a golden flute, weapons such as maces and Bahmani daggers, jade pitchers, ruby cups, diamond cubes, and most insultingly of all, the foot bracelets of the Sultan's wife. Finally, he demanded that Hussein stop eating beef and convert to worshipping Shiva. If he refused, the poet relates the following threat allegedly delivered by Rama Raya. "I'll spare neither Turk nor Turkish bow. I'll spare neither rich nor poor. I won't spare a single scholar or holy man, neither aged nor youth, neither young man or old." Whether this episode is true, or just one of Shawki's many poetic flourishes, what is certain is that Hussein had had enough. He put aside his differences with the other sultans of South India and united against Rama Raya. The sultans sealed their tentative alliance with marriages, even exchanging forts as part of the dowries, in order to settle the territorial disputes that had divided them. Through Rama Raya's arrogance, Vijayanagara had united its enemies against it, and they were now all marching south, hungry for vengeance. The year was 1565, and Rama Raya was now well into his 80s. Still, when he heard of the combined forces of the sultans marching south, he was determined to ride out with his great army and lead it to victory. He had good reason to be confident. Despite their alliance, the sultans of the Deccan were still no match for Vijayanagara. According to records, Rama Raya marched out with 70,000 cavalry and more than 500,000 foot soldiers. The entire army of Vijayanagara brought to bear for a final decisive battle for the future of South India. It's not clear how many soldiers the sultans brought to the battle, but it's clear that the odds didn't look good. They were not only outnumbered, but had also lost the advantage in firepower that their ancestors had enjoyed. In the more than 40 years since the armies of Krishnadeva had scraped a victory at Raichur, Vijayanagara had truly joined the gunpowder age. Some sources say that Rama Raya marched to meet the sultans with 1,000 cannons, while others put the number at more than 2,000. After a few skirmishes, the two armies finally met on the 23rd of January, 1565, on the plains that stretch alongside the Krishna River. Today, this confrontation is remembered by the name of a fortified town about 25 kilometers to the north, Talikota. The armies of the sultans had also learned lessons from their defeat 40 years earlier. They now had decades of experience in using cannons on the battlefield, and their tactics had evolved. They had brought with them gunners from Turkestan, then considered the best in the world. This time, instead of arranging their cannons in a single line that fired all at once, they were placed in three staggered lines, creating an almost continuous blanket of fire. When the battle began, the forces of Vijayanagara unleashed a barrage. Frishtar recounts how both armies being in motion soon came to battle, and the infidels began the attack by vast flights of rockets and rapid discharges of artillery. But the superior firepower of the sultans gained the upper hand. One source named Rafi al-Din Shirazi describes how the Muslims packed their cannons with copper coins in one of the first uses of what would become known as grapeshot. These superheated coins would have torn into the Vijayanagara soldiers. Rama Raya was carried around the battlefield in a palanquin. At one point, he's said to have sat on a throne, surrounded with piles of jewels and coins, handing them out to anyone who would charge into the heat of the battle. Despite the sultan's powerful guns, it seemed that once again, the overwhelming numbers of Vijayanagara would win the day. Frishtar writes that the sultans began to despair of victory and even to prepare for retreat. But then something happened to turn the tide completely. According to Frishtar, one of the sultan's elephants stampeded into the lines of Rama Raya's men, right towards the king of Vijayanagara, and in the path of the raging animal, his palanquin bearers fled, abandoning their king to be captured. Rama Raya was brought to Hussein and beheaded. Farishtar recounts how the head was placed on the point of a long spear, that his death might be thus announced to the enemy. After this, when they saw their chief destroyed, they fled in the utmost disorder from the field, and were pursued by the allies with such success that the river was dyed red with their blood. Those who were able, with horses and elephants, fled the battlefield, while a large number of foot soldiers were left behind to be massacred. The historian Mirza Ibrahim al-Zubayri, in his work Basatin al-Salatin, recalls how the sultans paused to rest and nurse the sick and wounded. Then they turned toward Vijayanagara. We can imagine the scenes as the frightened people of Vijayanagara watched the columns of the wounded and battle-stained soldiers winding down the road without their leaders, telling stories of the defeat. But they knew what to expect. When the armies of the sultans arrived, the leaders of Vijayanagara would have to admit defeat and agreed to pay an enormous sum in reparations. Some of Rama Raya's brothers managed to escape the battlefield and make it back to the city. They were now the assumed leaders of the empire and might have been expected to begin amassing a tribute payment to pay off the Muslim victors. Instead, the brothers gathered up all the treasure they could find, piled it into ox carts, and fled, leaving the city to its fate. Vijayanagara was now without an army, without leaders, and crucially, without any money to pay off its enemies. When the sultan's armies arrived and found the city's treasuries had been emptied, they began a campaign of looting. Over the next days and weeks, they stripped Vijayanagara of any wealth it had left. The Muslim poet Shawki, unsurprisingly, describes this event in triumphant terms. The Shah ordered the plunder of the city. The order was given to both noble and commoner. They then rendered the city desolate. They harassed and killed. Both open and hidden wealth were revealed. Treasure was brought up from beneath the ground. Another Muslim scholar, Al-Zubayri, claimed that they razed the lofty buildings and temples to the ground. The work of destruction was carried out with a vengeance. During the confusion and disorder following the Muslim invasion, the citizens out of fear lurked in their houses, cellars, wells, and reservoirs. Those that were well-to-do betook themselves to the neighboring mountains and caverns with their family and chattels. The Muslim army remained at Vijayanagara for about 6 months. To a distance of 20 leagues round the city, everything was burnt and reduced to ashes. With the sacking of the city, its empire fractured. The city itself was so destroyed that it is now totally in ruins and uninhabited, wrote Farishtar. The country has been seized on by the tributary chiefs, each of whom hath assumed an independent power in his own district. But the archaeological evidence suggests that the destruction was not as thorough as some of these accounts claim. In fact, fire damage has been observed only in the central temple and royal districts. Buildings such as the main palace complex and audience hall were burned, as well as others that represented the royal authority of the state. But in the residential parts of the city, the houses and markets, the destruction was much less pronounced, and there's no evidence of a wholesale burning of the city or of an enormous massacre. Still, the city does seem to have undergone a dramatic reduction in its population. The Italian merchant Cesare Federici, who visited and wrote an account 2 years afterwards, reports, "The four kings of the Moors entered the sacking of the city Bezeneger with great triumph, and there they remained 6 months, searching under houses and in all places for money and other things that were hidden. And then they departed to their own kingdoms, because they were not able to maintain such a kingdom as that was, so far distant from their own country. The city of Bezeneger is not altogether destroyed, yet the houses stand still, but empty. And there is dwelling in them nothing, as is reported, but tigers and other wild beasts." With their leaders gone, their administration collapsed, and the entire empire fragmenting, the people of Vijayanagara could not maintain their city. Bit by bit, the stone buildings that had survived the invading army were dismantled, or simply left to the vines and wild dogs. The great city of victory became a ghost town, and eventually even its grand name was dropped in favor of the name of one of its smaller districts, Hampi. Birds soon made their homes in the temple roofs. Indian robins, large grey babblers, blue rock thrushes, quails, and the rare yellow-throated bulbul. Grasses, and later banana and coconut palms and frangipanis, would sprout in the streets and yards, lifting the flagstones with their roots. Monkeys and bats would colonize the broken staircases and roof vaults. In the year 1800, a Scottish captain by the name of Colin Mackenzie was traveling in the south of India when he visited the ruined city of Vijayanagara, by then largely abandoned for more than 200 years. Mackenzie's visit to the ruins is recorded in a journal he kept at the time, which has never been published, but which survives in the British Library. In his neat, curling cursive, Mackenzie records what it was like to wander through the overgrown ruins of this great city, as his guides told him what they could about its history. South and half-southwest of Anagundi are still remaining many great ruins of the ancient city. Palaces, pagodas, droogs, and fortifications, to which the people give the name of Al-Putun, or the ruined city. The palaces with the grand stables for elephants and horses are there to be seen. Westward of this bathing place is a line of basins and cups cut out of fine black stones and placed on each side of a water conduit. They say that here was formerly the king's garden. Here and there, families of monkeys would have clambered over these great boulders, chattering and chasing one another. Mackenzie climbed up onto the rocky granite hills nearby, and from there sketched the first comprehensive map of the site. He was not a man given over to poetry, and he let his maps and sketches do the talking. But beside his map, he does describe in terse form the sights that he saw as he explored the ruins. Only a few decades later, in the 1850s, another East India Company officer, one Colonel Alexander Greenlaw, would visit the ruined site with an early camera and would take photographs of the ruins in their undisturbed condition. In them, we can see the carved edifices overgrown with mosses, growths of cactus-like euphorbia and grasses, their ornate cupolas strangled by vines. We can see the beautiful bathing houses spilling over with water weeds, the halls of long-dead kings now silent and shaded beneath cracking roofs. In his journal, Mackenzie describes the site of the city, now sunken beneath the earth. "This place is now almost ruined, but its remains are still very magnificent and curious. The houses of the inhabitants are entirely destroyed, and the ruins now form high banks and eminences, under which are buried many great houses, whose terraces are level with or sunk below the soil. Many of these we see in passing among the inner ruins." After the fall of their capital, the fugitive kings of Vijayanagara continued to rule in a much diminished form for several decades, shifting their courts to their remaining territories in southern Andhra. In their grandeur and ceremony, their processions and festivals, they attempted to recreate past splendors, but they now ruled over a tiny portion of what they once had. By the dawn of the 17th century, that power too evaporated, and the last of Vijayanagara's lords disappeared into obscurity. With the economic heart ripped out of the empire, towns and villages around the city of Vijayanagara and on the nearby coasts also went into decline. The dance of Shiva went on, and another empire passed into ruins. In 1626, little more than 60 years after the Battle of Talikota, the British East India Company built its first fortified port near the coastal town of Pulikat. This town was once the gateway by sea to the Vijayanagara Empire, but in the decades since its collapse, the town had fallen on hard times. The fort the British built was shoddy and indefensible, and the trading company abandoned it after only 6 years. But 2 years later, the British tried again, a little further to the south, at a small fishing village named Madras Patnam. It's said that the site was chosen because the head of the company factory, Francis Day, had fallen in love with a Tamil girl who lived nearby. At this time, the land was ruled by one of the lords left over from the fragmented and scattered Vijayanagara Empire. He was more than happy to grant a lease to that small and humble parcel to this foreign company in exchange for a share of their takings. This was the first true foothold of the British East India Company in India, a foothold that would grow into colonial domination of the entire landmass. And it came out of the weakness and dissolution of the empire of Vijayanagara. Around the globe, the new age would bring about an unprecedented collision of human societies. Some would survive this contact, while others would crumble entirely.